Hello and welcome to this reflection from Streatham Vale Baptist Church. Last week we spoke about defiant joy, the fact that we need to relearn how to play and cultivate joy as a natural part of our lives. This week I'd like to look at another characteristic, but this time it's one that we as Christians tend to shy away from: ambition. Often when we think of ambition, we think of selfishness and greed. We think of people who use and manipulate others to get ahead. But this is selfish ambition, a worldly ambition. Ambition by itself is neither good nor bad. It is neutral, and it can be used in either positive or negative ways. So I'm going to read firstly from James 3, verses 13 to 18. Who is wise and understanding among you? Let them show it by their good life, by deeds done in the humility that comes from wisdom. But if you harbour bitter envy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast about it or deny the truth. Such wisdom does not come down from heaven, but is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. For where there is envy and selfish ambition, there you find disorder and every evil practice. But the wisdom that comes from heaven is first of all pure, then peace-loving, considerate, submissive, full of mercy and good fruit, impartial and sincere. Peacemakers who sow in peace reap a harvest of righteousness. So when we think about ambition, we read passages like this one in James and we think, see, James tells us that ambition is bad, so we should reject any ambition. However, that's not actually what James says. His words say selfish ambition does not come from heaven, but is earthly, unspiritual, and demonic. We have allowed the concept of ambition to be corrupted by the selfishness, or in other words, the sinfulness of the world. We need to redeem ambition for the sake of God's kingdom. God calls us to be humble, but he does not call us to be ineffective, apathetic, or complacent. Humility is not the opposite of ambition. Allow God to change the concept of ambition from selfishness to holiness. Our lives should be fueled by the holy ambition, the eager, urgent desire to see God's kingdom come in the world around us. We see God's use of ambition throughout the Bible as he places in his people the desire to see his kingdom. I'm going to read a little bit of the story of Nehemiah. So I'm going to start at Nehemiah 1. And finish at Nehemiah 2, verse 6. In the month of Kislev, in the 20th year, while I was in the citadel of Susa, Hanani, one of my brothers, came from Judah with some other men, and I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that had survived the exile, and also about Jerusalem. They said to me, "Those who survived the exile and are back in the province are in great trouble and disgrace. The walls of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates have been burned with fire." When I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. Then I said, "Lord, the God of heaven, the great and awesome God who keeps his covenant of love with those who love him and keeps his commandments, let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer of your servant is praying before you day and night for your servants, the people of Israel. I confess the sins we Israelites, including myself and my father's family, have committed against you. We have acted very wickedly towards you. We have not obeyed the commands, decrees, and laws that you gave your servant Moses. Remember the instruction you gave your servant Moses, saying, 'If you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the nations, but if you return to me and obey my commands, then even if your exiled people are at the farthest horizon, I will gather them from there and bring them to the place I have chosen as a dwelling for my name. They are your servants and your people, whom you have redeemed by your great strength and your mighty hand. Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of this your servant, and to the prayer of your servants who delight in revering your name. Give your servant success today by granting him favour in the presence of this man. I was cupbearer to the king. In the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was brought from him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. I had not been sad in his presence before, so the king asked me, "Why does your face look so sad when you are not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart." I was very much afraid, but I said to the king, "May the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city where my ancestors are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire?" The king said to me, "What is it you want?" Then I prayed to the God of heaven, and I answered the king, "If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favour in his sight, let him send me to the city of Judah, where my ancestors are buried, so I can rebuild it." Then the king, with his queen sitting beside him, asked me, "How long will your journey take, and when will you get back?" It pleased the king to send me, so I set a time. The first thing to note in Nehemiah's story is the importance of keeping focused on God's kingdom vision rather than thinking of our own concerns. Nehemiah was the cupbearer to King Artaxerxes, a trusted official responsible for tasting the king's wine to ensure it was free from poison. This was a position of considerable influence and one which gave him regular access to the king. One thing I love is that Nehemiah didn't allow this position to make him complacent or apathetic to the matters that God cares about. Nehemiah could have heard the report about Jerusalem and said, "Oh, that's sad. I'll pray for them." All the while thinking, "I'm glad I'm in a good position. At least I'm not affected by what's going on." I wonder how many of us are guilty of doing exactly this. At times I know that I have definitely had this kind of thought process, where I think, "Well, that's sad and I will pray for it, but ultimately it doesn't really affect me." It's so easy for us to get comfortable in the situation we're in that we stop seeing the world with God's kingdom vision. Satan tries to sway us away from God's kingdom with the disastrous temptation to give our attention to two questions. Am I and my people good and safe and happy? Will we have enough? These two questions force our attention to stay within the bounds of our own concerns, and it stops us from seeing the things that concern God. The problem for much of the Western Church is that we have collapsed inwards rather than expanding outwards. We have lost our focus on kingdom values and instead become more interested in personal peace and affluence. Where is your focus? What questions motivate the decisions that you make? Are they questions of personal peace and affluence? Or questions about God's kingdom and purpose? Will you care about the kingdom purposes rather than yourself? Nehemiah did not lose his focus on God's kingdom. We are told, "When I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven." He was not just sympathetic to the plight of those in Jerusalem. No, his heart was broken. He found himself full of grief and compassion. Nehemiah's focus on God's kingdom caused him to be moved emotionally. Which leads me nicely to my next point, that having a kingdom-focused vision means that God stirs our hearts for the things that he cares about. God puts desires in our hearts, that passion for a cause or a value of God, that concern for a group of people or situation. He causes us to feel a sense of discontentment about the injustice regarding a certain issue. But then there is a moment in which our discontent can either become crystallized into a powerful urge to do something about the situation, or be ignored and allowed to just become part of the normal life. When our discontent becomes crystallized, this is the fuel of cultural change. That moment in our spirits which just says, enough, no more. Nehemiah heard the report about Jerusalem and his heart was stirred, and his spirit said, no, enough, I cannot let this continue. When we experience this moment, it may not look dramatic and impressive. It may look to others to be a tiny thing, but it is that moment when God calls us to respond to the burden that he has placed on our hearts. But when we have this moment, Satan tries to turn us away from action. He comes in with the so-called voice of reasonableness, the voice that says, what can you do? You are only one person. This is too big a problem. There is someone else who can do it better. You can't do anything to change this. Does any of that sound familiar? This voice of reasonableness says to us, because you can't do anything about it, satisfy your urge by half-heartedly praying for the issue. Listening to this voice of reasonableness allows the issue to become normalized, and we choose not to act. God calls us to allow our discontent to crystallize into a firm commitment to follow him and respond with prayer and action. The heart of God is not a passive heart for the broken in the world. God is active and working, and he calls us to join in and be active and working with him. What is God stirring in your heart? What thing, issue, cause, people is building discontent inside of you? How is God calling you to crystallize that discontent into faith and action? How is God stirring your heart? God also stirs our hearts for the things that he has put us in a position to do something about. I love reading about how God plans things and fits things together that we wouldn't even think about. So we're told that Nehemiah is in the citadel of Susa and his brother comes back from Jerusalem. We're not sure why he's been there, but he was there for some reason. And when he comes back, Nehemiah questions him about Jerusalem. Notice it is Nehemiah who questions his brother about the exiles and about Jerusalem. It doesn't seem like Hanani volunteers the information. But Nehemiah is stirred by that godly sense of discontent and so demands to know what is happening in Jerusalem. The amazing thing is that Nehemiah is in a position to do something about it. He is the cupbearer to the king. He is able to speak directly to the king to plead the case for Jerusalem. Where has God placed you? Who have you got influence among? Who are you able to speak directly to? God places us where we are on purpose. He wants you to impact the environment around you for his kingdom. Spend time with God, seeking his purpose for placing you in the situations, the environments, and the social groups that you're in. Nehemiah's crystallization of discontent leads him to radical, sacrificial action. And there are a number of things that happens as a result of Nehemiah's discontent with the situation. So firstly, before he does anything else, he comes before God in prayer. Now this might sound like I'm going back to the course of action suggested by the voice of reasonableness, which said, oh, just pray for the situation because you can't do anything about it. But there is a difference to the way these prayers are prayed. Satan says, just send up a half-hearted prayer and forget about it. Nehemiah got down, wept, mourned, fasted, and prayed fervently. He didn't just send one prayer up to satisfy his sense of discontent. He was overcome with a need to pray fervently, fervently, desperately. He allowed his need to pray to take over his days. In his time of prayer, Nehemiah started with who God is and what he says. He reminds himself of the might and power of God. Lord, the God of heaven, the great and awesome God. By doing this, Nehemiah reminds and encourages himself with the truth that nothing is impossible for God. God can work miracles to resolve even the most hopeless of situations. And this gives Nehemiah hope that not all is not lost for Jerusalem, because he believes in a God who can do the impossible. He then moves to praying about God's compassion and love. God who keeps his covenant of love with those who love him and keep his commandments. Nehemiah reminds himself that God is not just mighty and powerful. He's also loving and faithful. Even when we break our promises, God remains true to what he has said. This was important for Nehemiah as it reminded him that not only was God powerful enough to do it, he also cared enough to do it. Nehemiah lived at a time when other nations attempted to please or placate the gods they believed in with rituals and sacrifices and other actions that would try and show that they needed to respond. The other nations believed in gods that were generally disinterested in the affairs of the world unless they had been given enough to make it worth intervening. Nehemiah reminds himself that he believes in the God who cares and loves the world. God doesn't need to be coerced or bribed into intervening in the world. He is already there working and is calling us to catch up with what he is doing. Nehemiah links his prayers with the character and nature of God, so that his prayer is not, God, I've got a problem, but God, we've got a problem. He aligns himself with God's promises, his words, and his commitment to following through. And he recognises that the problem is not his alone, but something God has compassion for too. Secondly, as Nehemiah comes before God in prayer, he personally identifies with the issue. He stands with the Israelites in Jerusalem and all those who have been taken into exile. He places himself firmly in the situation, standing with the people that are hurting. Nehemiah is in a good situation. He doesn't need to see this change because his life is actually pretty decent. But he stands with the people whose lives are broken. And he fasts, weeps, and prays with them and on their behalf. It is a startling fact that we cannot effectively influence something that we do not personally identify with. Do you identify with a thing that God causes your heart to stir about? Do you recognize that this world is connected with each other through God, our Creator? How can you identify with the things that God has caused you to be concerned about? But Nehemiah doesn't just identify with the situation that the people are in. He also personally identifies with the sins of the world. He recognises that the situation has been caused, at least in part, by the unfaithfulness of the Israelites toward God. Nehemiah places himself amongst those who have sinned and confesses those sins for himself and also on the behalf of the whole community. Our society has an obsession with personal culpability and blame. If something goes wrong, someone is to blame and compensation should be given. we don't like to recognise that we are all united in our ability for wrongdoing. This was clear to me at one of my previous workplaces. Whenever someone had found something someone had done wrong, there was a demand for the person responsible to come forward publicly so the blame could be assigned to them personally. There was no recognition that we all make mistakes, and as long as we continue to learn from them, we didn't need to be publicly assigned the blame. There is a tendency for us not to take responsibility and repent for things that we haven't personally done. We don't like to be accused of things that our ancestors have done and that we have benefited from. Our individualism tries so hard to detach ourselves from the history and ancestry that brought us to where we are. Yet that is not what we see in the Bible. Here, Nehemiah personally identifies with the sinfulness of Israel. I confess the sins we Israelites, including myself and my father's family, have committed against you. We have acted very wickedly towards you. We have not obeyed the commands, decrees, and laws you gave your servant Moses. When we pray, do we confess the sins of the world as well as our own? Just think, what impact might it make if we learn to personally identify with this suffering, sinful world? How might it cause us to be motivated into action? Through Nehemiah's prayers, God moves him to redemptive action. I find it interesting that the section telling us about Nehemiah's prayer ends with a statement that seems almost out of place. We get to the point where Nehemiah has pleaded with God, "Give your servant success today by granting him favour in the presence of this man." And then we have that statement, "I was cupbearer to the king." Now, this is speculative, so feel free to disagree with me. But it seems that after Nehemiah's prayer asking God to speak, to intervene, to give guidance, God reminded Nehemiah that he was cupbearer to the king and thus had a position of influence. It seems that God's answer to Nehemiah's prayer was, "I have already placed you where you need to be. Now it is up to you to step forward in faith." That is a pretty terrifying response to the prayer. And I'm slightly comforted that it seemed to take Nehemiah a while to respond as he needed to. Nehemiah was given the report about Jerusalem in the month of Kislev, and he spoke to the king in the month of Nisan. This is a period of 4 months. The time was spent in prayer and fasting, but I also wonder if some of the time was spent with Nehemiah questioning if he had heard God properly, and then psyching himself up for the task that God had given him. When you pray fervently, identifying yourself with what you're praying for, you need to be prepared because God responds and we may not like the answer. What is he saying to you? Can you find the courage to trust God, to rely on the Holy Spirit and step out in faith? Nehemiah stood in the king's presence with a sad demeanour, something that could get him executed, as no one was supposed to be sad in the presence of the king. But he trusted God and demonstrated his sorrow. And the response allowed Nehemiah to go to Jerusalem to rebuild the city. God calls us outside our comfort zone into potential danger and asks us to trust him to guide the way. How is God calling you to act with godly ambition, to follow him with that urgent determination to see his kingdom come on earth as in heaven? A.W. Tozer says, "Complacency is the deadly foe of all spiritual growth. Acute desire must be present, or there will be no manifestation of Christ to his people. He waits to be wanted. Too bad that with many of us, he waits so long, so very long, in vain. How can our community, how can our lives, how can our very world be different if we are filled with holy ambition to see God's kingdom here?